Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, chair of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and chair of this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Quammen. He was born in 1948 and raised in the suburbs of Cincinnati, closely adjacent to a hardwood forest, in which he spent much of his boyhood. Then bulldozers came and scraped the forest away, a formative experience. In 1973, after education at Yale and Oxford and the publication of one novel, he moved to Montana, not foreseeing he would stay there a lifetime. His second book, a spy novel, appeared in 1983. Another spy novel, The Soul of Viktor Tromko, based on historical events in the case of a certain Russian defector, was published by Doubleday in 1987 and sank like a hot pistol into the Potomac. Bloodline, Stories of Fathers and Sons, was published by Grey Wolf a year later. Meanwhile, he had transmogrified into a nonfiction writer. In 1981, he began as a columnist for Outside Magazine and continued that role for 15 years. Selections of the columns, along with some longer pieces done for Outside and other magazines, comprise his four books of short nonfiction: Natural Acts, 1985, The Flight from the Iguana, 1988, Wild Thoughts from Wild Places, 1998, and The Boilerplate Rhino, 2000. A revised, culled, and re-expanded edition of Natural Acts was published by W.W. Norton in 2008. His three full-length nonfiction books are The Song of the Dodo, 1996, Monster of Gold, 2003, and The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, 2006. His fourth book is Spillover. In 1999, he was asked by National Geographic magazine to write a series of three stories about J. Michael Fay's epic 2,000-mile survey hike through the forests of Central Africa, an expedition that became known as the Mega Transect. He walked for 8 weeks with Fay across portions of the Congo River Basin. After his feet healed and those stories had run, he continued working for National Geographic and now holds a position as contributing writer. In 2004, he wrote the National Geographic cover story, Was Darwin Wrong?, and won his third National Magazine Award. He has received honorary doctorates from Montana State University and Colorado College. He has also been helped materially along the way in his education and his leaner financing years by a Rhodes Scholarship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a Lannan Literary Award for nonfiction. From 2007 to 2009, he served as Wallace Stegner Professor of Western American Studies, a rotating three-year gig by definition, at Montana State University. He lives in Bozeman, Montana, with his wife, Betsy Gaines Quammen, founding director of the Tributary Fund, a conservation organization that collaborates with religious leaders in Mongolia and elsewhere. Having retired from whitewater kayaking and ice hockey, the diversions of his impetuous middle age, he continues to bicycle and ski, telemark, free your heels, etc. He also spends quite a lot of time walking two large white dogs. And now, Dr. Quammen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's see, I'm going to adjust this a tiny bit. Thank you for that introduction, Bill. Nice to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I appreciate the hospitality, and now you all know more about me than I remember about myself. And most of that was accurate, although I am going to, with your permission, make one small but important correction. I'm not Dr. Quammen. I'm Mr. Quammen. I practice science explication without a license. My background in ecology, evolutionary biology, and molecular biology, which this book is full of, is strictly autodidactic, on-the-job training over the course of 35 years. It's been my journalistic beat. So, but the rest of that, including the white dogs, is. I'll confess to it. We're a nice, small, intimate group, but we're going to have some fun. I'm going to talk about this book and the subject matter, talk about gruesome and horrific diseases and tell a few stories and talk about some ideas and read a few bits of it to give you a little bit of the flavor of the book. And then we'll have some conversation, I hope. I'll leave plenty of time for questions. This spillover is a book about scary new emerging diseases and where they emerge from. And where they emerge from generally is wildlife, other species. One of the entry points to this subject is the daily news. Any of you who have been watching the news just in the last 3 or 4 months have been hearing about this subject in lots of little bits and pieces. You've been hearing about hantavirus affecting people who camped in certain cabins, stayed in certain cabins at Yosemite. 3 people dead of hantavirus this summer in the U.S. after experiences in Yosemite. You've been hearing about West Nile fever, especially in Texas, North Texas, Dallas area. 15 people dead of West Nile fever in the Dallas area since July. You may or may not have been hearing about an outbreak of Ebola virus disease in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's still going on. Last I saw, there are 36 people dead in the Democratic Republic of the Congo from this Ebola outbreak. There has been another Ebola outbreak in Uganda that happened earlier in the summer. That outbreak has been contained and ended. It was actually a completely separate outbreak from the one just across the border in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and I'll maybe get to explain what I mean by separate. You've been hearing about these things. You hear about Lyme disease in all over the country, but particularly in the Northeast. You may have heard, although probably not, about a Saudi Arabian man who died of a SARS-like coronavirus a couple of weeks ago. And there is another man, last I heard, in critical condition in a hospital in London with the same virus. One man dead, one in hospital. Scientists all over the world are watching that case, watching that virus. Why? Because SARS is one of the scariest of these emerging diseases that we have seen in the last 10 years, in the last 20 or 30 years. And if something is SARS-like, it rings very loud alarm bells in the scientific disease community. So you hear about these things, and there's a tendency for them to be portrayed as independent events, independent misfortunes, poor people who were in Yosemite and got hantavirus, and then those faraway Congolese folks who are dying in their villages of Ebola. One of the points I want to bring to you, one of the points that I tried to make lucid in the book, is that these various disease outbreaks, these emerging diseases that we hear about all over the world, are not independent events, and they're not simply misfortunes that are happening to us. They're parts of a pattern, and that pattern reflects things that we're doing. And what we're doing is 2 things, and I can express them in 2 words. Disruption and connection. Those are the yin and yang of the field of emerging diseases and why these diseases seem to be getting worse over time, getting to be more of a problem. Disruption and connection. Disruption in the sense that we humans now number 7 billion on this planet. We're headed toward a population of 9 billion, probably before we peak, if we do peak. And we are going into the wild places of the planet more and more insistently than ever before. We're disrupting ecosystems in the places where ecosystems are most rich and most diverse. We're cutting our way through the Congo. We're cutting our way through the Amazon. We're cutting our way through Madagascar and Borneo and Southeast Asia. We're building roads. We're building timber camps. We're building villages. We're building settlements of all sort, building mines. We are killing the animals that live in those forests and eating them. We are transporting animals from those places to different parts of the world for medical research. We're moving exotic pets around the world. And in the course of causing that disruption, we're exposing ourselves to new pathogens, new disease bugs, in particular to viruses. As we expose ourselves to those viruses, it presents an opportunity for those viruses to leap into us, to spill over. That's why my book is titled Spillover, to spill over into us. And so these new diseases enter humans. They find themselves in a new kind of host. In some cases, they burn out. In some cases, meaning that they might kill a few people and then the outbreak ends. In some cases, they become innocent passenger viruses and have no effect. There's a wonderful virus known as simian foamy virus. One of my favorites, partly because it's got a vivid name and partly because it doesn't hurt us. It doesn't cause disease. It's a passenger virus. It passes into humans from macaques in Southeast Asia, particularly sacred monkeys and monkey temples in Buddhist and Hindu monkey temples. There's a section of the book where I describe work by a couple of researchers monitoring the passage of simian foamy virus from macaques into humans. Doesn't cause disease. Why are they monitoring it? Because it's sort of a sentinel. It's a representation of how much opportunity there is in contact between these macaques and humans for the passage of viruses of all kinds. And in some cases, the viruses pass into us, the new human host, and they take hold and they cause trouble. They're virulent. They cause disease. They kill. And before they kill, they pass onward to another individual human. They become not just small outbreaks, but epidemics, and in some cases, pandemic. AIDS is a zoonotic disease. Did I use that term yet, zoonotic? All of these things, diseases that pass from non-human animals into humans, are known by the technical name of zoonotic diseases. A zoonosis is an animal infection transmissible to humans, and when that transmitted, spilled over virus or bacterium or fungus, when it causes disease in the new host in humans, we call it a zoonotic disease. So the subject of the book in general is zoonotic diseases, and the dynamics of them. In a sense, it's about the ecology and evolutionary biology of scary viruses. It's about how these things function and why it's important to understand how they function. I'm going to read the first page of the book just to give you a little bit of flavor. I don't like introductions. I don't like forwards and prefaces. When I open a nonfiction book, I like it to begin right away, getting into the material. There's always a need to set the stage a little bit, present the context a little bit, but still you want to get into story. I'm going to read the first page, which is the first numbered section of the book, just to give you a little flavor and bring us into the story. The virus, now known as Hendra, wasn't the first of the scary new bugs. Hendra, H-E-N-D-R-A. It wasn't the worst. Compared to some others, it seems relatively minor. Its mortal impact in numerical terms was small at the start and has remained small. Its geographical scope was narrowly local, and later episodes haven't carried it much more widely. It made its debut near Brisbane, Australia, in 1994. Initially, there were two cases, only one of them fatal. No, wait, correction. There were two human cases, one human fatality. Other victims suffered and died too, more than a dozen, equine victims, and their story is part of this story. The subject of animal disease and the subject of human disease are, as we'll see, strands of one braided cord. The original emergence of Hendra virus didn't seem very dire or newsworthy unless you happened to live in Eastern Australia. It couldn't match an earthquake, a war, a schoolboy gun massacre, a tsunami. But it was peculiar. It was spooky. Slightly better known now, at least among disease scientists and Australians, and therefore slightly less spooky, Hendra virus still seems peculiar. It's a paradoxical thing, marginal, sporadic, but in some larger sense representative. For exactly that reason, it marks a good point from which to begin toward understanding the emergence of certain virulent new realities on this planet. Realities that include the death of more than 30 million people since 1981. Those realities involve a phenomenon called zoonosis. A zoonosis is an animal infection transmissible to humans, as I've already said. There are more such diseases than you might expect. AIDS is one. Influenza is a whole category of others. Pondering them as a group tends to reaffirm the old Darwinian truth, the darkest of his truths, well known and persistently forgotten, the old Darwinian truth that humanity is a kind of animal, inextricably connected with other animals, in origin and descent, in sickness and in health. Pondering them individually, for starters, this relatively obscure case from Australia, provides a salubrious reminder that everything, including pestilence, comes from somewhere. And then I go into the story of this particular disease, known as Hendra virus because it began in a suburb of Brisbane, Australia, called Hendra. September 1994, a horse gets sick, a racehorse, a mare, who is pregnant, and she's been pastured out at what they call a spelling paddock, a pasture on the outskirts of town, away from the stable itself. She gets sick, and the trainer brings her back to his stable to take care of her. She gets sicker. Her face swells up. She gets clumsy. She runs a high fever. Bloody froth starts coming up her throat, coming out of her mouth and out of her nostrils. The trainer tries to force feed her, tries to get some shredded carrot and molasses down her throat. She can't swallow. She can't swallow. He's got his arm down her throat as she's got this bloody froth coming up. The horse dies. About 2 weeks pass. He's thinking, I wonder if she got bit by a snake. I wonder if she ate some toxic fodder out in that spelling paddock, that rough meadow. He doesn't know what happened. And then another horse gets sick in his stables. And then another horse, and then another horse. And they all show these same symptoms, one after another. They're going down like dominoes. He calls his veterinarian, a tall, soft-spoken guy named Peter Reed, Dr. Peter Reed. Peter Reed comes over, tries to help with these horses. And there's a stable hand, too. So the three of them are trying to save these horses. These horses are dying. Seven horses die in 24 hours. One of them is dying in such misery that Peter Reed can't get close enough to it to give it a euthanizing injection. And the horse dies without him being able to do that. He told me that it was just miserable. If this was a virus, he told me in retrospect, he had never seen a virus go through horses like this before. And then the trainer got sick with what seemed like a bad flu and went to the hospital. And then the stable hand got sick and went home to suffer. Peter Reed, the veterinarian, didn't get sick. The trainer died. Stable foreman slowly got better. The health authorities came out. They took samples from the dead horses, and they found a virus. It looked like measles, looked a little bit like measles. They took a sample from the dead trainer. They found the same virus. They named it Hendra virus after this suburb where all this had happened. And then they said, well, we've got a new virus, a dangerous new virus. But where did it come from? It spilled over from something, from some other animal. All viruses have to be in living cells to replicate. So a virus has to live somewhere in an animal or a plant in a living organism within its cells. An ecologist named Hume Field went looking for the virus. It became his PhD project. He sampled kangaroos. He sampled wombats. He sampled potoroos. He sampled rats. He sampled every animal that he could find around the stables and around that that pasture. And he didn't find the virus. And then he thought to sample bats. And he found the virus. And when I tracked these fellows down, after hearing part of the story, the veterinarian, Peter Reed, took me out to what had been that pasture. It was now a housing development. All these sort of ticky-tacky houses in a row in this new little suburb. And one of the streets, he drove me through, and one of the streets was a little sort of a circle with a round, kind of a roundabout, and it was called Calliope Circuit. And in the middle of that circle was standing a tree, a fig tree, a native Moreton Bay fig. And Peter Reed pointed at it, and he said to me, "That's it. That's the bloody tree." And what he meant was, that's where the bats had gathered. And that's where the horse had sought shade. That's where the bats had eaten figs, dropped the pulp, dropped feces, dropped urine, dropped virus onto the grass. The original horse had eaten that grass, had gotten sick with the virus, taken it back to the stable when she was taken there, infected all of the other horses, infected the trainer, infected the stable hand. That's a spillover. That's how a new disease starts. I talk about a number of these diseases. I talk about Ebola in the book, SARS, a disease called Nipah that emerges in Bangladesh and in Malaysia. It's closely related to Hendra. I talk about the influenzas. I talk about all of these things. And essentially, I chase around the world following some very interesting, bright, gutsy scientists who are doing research on this in the wild, trying to solve questions like, what is the reservoir host of this particular new disease? What causes it to spill over when it does spill over? Where does it come from ultimately, and what can we do about it? And I tell those stories in the book. I don't want you to think that this is just a gruesome book full of an attempt to explain an important subject. It's also, I hope, a page-turner. It's got a lot of adventure in it. It's got some mystery, some suspense, an element of quest, a little bit of humor. It's not a very funny book. But I hope it's the funniest book about Ebola you'll ever read. I want to read you another little section. This is about the emergence of SARS. We know that SARS came out of southern China in 2003. We know in retrospect that it also emerged from a bat. It's a virus that belongs to the coronavirus family. Originally, it was thought to have its reservoir host in a species of mammal related to mongooses called the masked palm civet. And the masked palm civet is a wild animal, but it's both caught and raised in captivity for food in southern China. There's a great vogue in southern China for what's called wild flavor, which is the eating of wildlife in restaurants. And this is not poor people in the villages hunting wildlife for subsistence. This is upscale people who want something just a little bit special, and what they choose to eat is wildlife. It emerged from southern China. It got to Hong Kong, and I'm going to explain how it got to Hong Kong. And then from Hong Kong, it spread in the bodies of people who were infected but not very sick yet. It spread to Toronto, to Beijing, to Hanoi, to Singapore, before we knew it, in a matter of a day or two. It had gotten halfway around the world, and people were dying in Toronto. People were dying in Singapore. There were secondary cases that were occurring because this is an airborne virus, and healthcare workers were becoming infected and dying. Eventually, about 9,000 people, about 8,000 people were infected with SARS, 900 of whom died, more than a 10% lethality rate. And the disease scientists I've talked to have said that was really the scary one. That was a major bullet that we dodged. That's one that could have been much, much more serious. But good, fast science and public health measures managed to control it. But I want to read you about two pages here about how it came out of China. There was one of the very earliest cases, victims, in southern China was a wholesale seafood merchant named Zhou Zuofeng. And he became infected. Well, let me read. No one seems to know where Mr. Zhou picked up his infection, though presumably it wasn't from seafood. Fish and marine crustaceans have never been implicated among the possible reservoirs for the pathogen causing SARS. Zhou ran a shop in a major fish market, and possibly his sphere of activities intersected with other live markets, these big live animal markets they call wet markets in southern China. Possibly his activities intersected with those, including the markets that offered domestic and wild birds and mammals for sale as food. Whatever its source, the infection took hold and went to his lungs, causing coughing and fever, and drove him to seek help at a Guangzhou hospital. Guangzhou is one of the large cities in the province of Guangdong, southern China. At a Guangzhou hospital on January 30th, 2003. Zhou remained at that hospital only 2 days, during which he infected at least 30 healthcare workers. His condition worsening, he was transferred to a second hospital, a place that specialized in handling cases of atypical pneumonia. Atypical pneumonia was what the World Health Organization was calling this thing during the early days. That's what you call a respiratory disease when you don't know what the hell it is. Two more doctors, two nurses, and another ambulance driver were infected during his transfer as Zhou gasped for breath, vomited, and spattered phlegm around the ambulance. At the second hospital, he was intubated to save him from suffocation. That is, a flexible tube was inserted deep into his mouth, past his glottis, and down his windpipe into his lungs to help with breathing. This event represents another important clue toward explaining how SARS spread so effectively through hospitals around the world. Intubation is a simple procedure, at least in theory, but it can be difficult to execute amid the gag reflexes, sputters, and expectorations of the patient. The task was especially hard with Zhou, a portly man, sedated and feverish, and though his disease hadn't yet been identified, the attending doctors and nurses seemed to have had some sense of the danger to which they were being exposed. They knew by then that this atypical pneumonia, this whatever, was more transmissible and more lethal than pneumonias of the common sort. Each time they began to insert the tube, according to an account by Thomas Abraham, a veteran foreign correspondent based in Hong Kong, each time there was an eruption of bloody mucus. Abraham continues, he says this. It splashed onto the floor, the equipment, and the faces and gowns of the medical staff. They knew the mucus was highly infectious, and in the normal course of things, they would have cleaned themselves up as quickly as possible. But with a critically ill patient kicking and heaving around, a tube half inserted into his windpipe, and mucus and blood spurting out, there was no way any of them could leave. That's Thomas Abraham. At that hospital, 23 doctors and nurses became infected from Zhou, plus 18 other patients and their relatives. 19 members of his own family also got sick. Zhou himself would eventually become known among medical staff in Guangzhou as the Poison King. I don't know how to say that in Chinese, but I'm sure there's a vivid Mandarin phrase for the poison king. He survived the illness, though many people who caught it from him, directly or indirectly through a long chain of contacts, many of them did not survive. One of those secondary cases was a 64-year-old physician named Liu Jianlun, a professor of nephrology at the teaching hospital where Zhou had first been treated. Professor Liu began feeling flu-like symptoms on February 15th, 2 weeks after his exposure to Zhou, and then seemed to get better. Well enough, he thought, to follow through on his plans to attend his nephew's wedding in Hong Kong. He and his wife took the three-hour bus ride from Guangzhou on February 21st, crossed the border, spent an evening with family, and then checked into a large mid-range hotel called the Metropole, favored by businessmen and tourists in the Kowloon district of Hong Kong. I stayed at the same hotel when I went there to research this, just to see what it looked like. They were given, the doctor and his wife, they were given room 911 across from the elevators in the middle of a long corridor, a fact that became central to later epidemiological investigations. Two fateful things happened that night at the Metropole Hotel. The professor's condition worsened, and at some point, he seems to have sneezed or coughed or, depending on which account you believe, vomited in the ninth floor corridor. In any case, he shed a sizable dose of the pathogen that was making him sick, enough to infect at least 16 other guests and a visitor to the hotel. Professor Liu thereby became the second known super spreader of the epidemic. That's the term the scientists use, super spreader. The poison king was the first super spreader. Among the hotel guests sharing floor 9 was a 78-year-old grandmother from Canada. She had come to visit family in China and in Hong Kong, and then spent several nights at the Metropole along with her husband as part of an airline hotel package. Her room was 904, just across the corridor and a few steps down from Professor Liu's. Her stay overlapped with his presence for only one night, the night of February 21st, 2003. Maybe they shared a ride on the elevator. Maybe they passed in the hallway. Maybe they never laid eyes on each other. No one knows, not even the epidemiologists. What's known is that the next day, the professor awoke feeling too sick to attend any wedding and instead checked himself into the nearest hospital. He would die on March 4th. One day after Professor Liu left the Metropole, the Canadian grandmother left too, having finished her Hong Kong visit. Infected, but not yet symptomatic, and presumably feeling fine, she boarded her flight home to Toronto, taking SARS global. So that's how one began. And there are stories like that, not always so precisely documented by epidemiologists and others, but there are stories like that for all of these diseases. Little events that lead to big consequences. There's a virus called Nipah, which I don't think, I guess I did mention. It's related to Hendra virus. Nipah virus resides in bats, again, in the area of Malaysia and Bangladesh. Big fruit bats of the genus Pteropus with like 2 and 3 foot wingspans. And falls out of bats into other creatures. Sometimes pigs, sometimes humans. In Malaysia, it first got on the radar screen in 1998 when pigs started getting sick. And there are a lot at that time. There were a lot of big factory-scale pig farms in central and northern Malaysia. And as a secondary income stream, some of these pig farmers had planted fruit trees around their pigsties, even mango trees shading the pigsties in some cases. they noticed that bats were coming to those fruit trees, partly because elsewhere in Malaysia, much of the native forest, their usual natural habitat, had been logged, had been torn down. So bats were coming closer to humans because of disruption. They were coming in to feed at the domestic fruit trees, including the ones that shaded the pigsties. They ate the mango, they dropped the mango pulp, they dropped feces, they dropped urine, they dropped virus into the pigsties. The pigs picked it up, got sick, started coughing, barking, chuffing, infecting one another, was spreading among the pigs. One fellow told me that this eventually became what they called the one-mile barking cough, because you could hear it coming from the pigsty across the hill towards your pigsty. And then it started getting into people. Eventually killed 109 pig industry workers, pig farmers, abattoir workers, butchers, pork sellers, 109 people. And in order to stop this outbreak, the government of Malaysia ordered the killing, the culling of 1.1 million pigs. And there are not factory-scale, mango-shaded pigsties, pig farms in Malaysia anymore. And they haven't had an outbreak since this 1998-1999 outbreak. The virus has disappeared. It's gone back into the bat, and it remains there. In Bangladesh, it's a slightly different story, but I won't tell that one right now, because I want to read you another piece, another little piece, and then maybe I'll be done and we'll have a conversation. You've heard me mentioning bats, Nipah virus, reservoir in bats, Hendra virus, reservoir in bats, SARS, reservoir in bats. We know that rabies has one of its major reservoirs in bats. Australian bat lysovirus, a lot of these things. For one reason or another, reasons that scientists speculate about, have their reservoirs in bats. Another of those is Marburg. Marburg is an African virus with a German name. The reason it has a German name is because it first emerged in 1967 in some monkeys that were shipped up for medical research from Uganda to Marburg in Germany. And the laboratory workers who were working with these monkeys suddenly started getting sick and dying. And a virus was detected, and it was named Marburg after the city where the labs were. But its natural habitat is in East Africa, in Central Africa. It spills over every so often. Maybe every 5 years there's an outbreak. And although it was carried to Germany in monkeys, the monkeys got sick too, and it was suspected that monkeys, these particular monkeys, I think they were African green monkeys, maybe vervet monkeys, they were not the reservoir host. Something else probably was the reservoir host. So scientists from the CDC, among other places, wanted to solve the question. They were watching, trying to figure out what is the reservoir of Marburg. So I'm going to read you about 3.5 pages here and then stop. This is about the kind of people who do this work in the field and the kind of circumstances that they face. Then in 2007, Marburg virus reappeared, this time among miners in Uganda. It was a small outbreak, affecting only 4 men, of whom one died, but it served as an opportunity to gain new insight into the virus, thanks in part to a quickly responsive multinational team. The 4 victims all worked at a site called Kitaka Cave, not far from Queen Elizabeth National Park, in the southwestern corner of Uganda. They dug galena, which is lead ore, plus a little bit of gold. The word mine caught the attention of some scientists within the CDC's special pathogen branch in Atlanta, because they already had reason to suspect that Marburg's reservoir, whatever it was, might be associated with cave-like environments. Several of the previous Marburg outbreaks included patients whose case histories involved visits to or work in caves and mines. So when the response team arrived at Kitaka Cave in August 2007, they were ready to go underground. This group included scientists from the CDC, from the National Institute for Communicable Diseases in South Africa, and the World Health Organization, WHO, in Geneva. The CDC sent Pierre Rolland. I mentioned a few of these characters that have already been mentioned in the book. Jonathan Towner, a filovirus researcher, worked on Marburg and Ebola. And Brian Ammon. Pierre Formonti from WHO, Alan Kemp from Johannesburg, etc. All of them possessed extensive experience with Ebola and Marburg, gained variously through outbreak responses, lab research, and field studies. Brian Ammon, was a mammalogist with a special affinity for bats. During a conversation at the CDC, he described to me what it was like to go to Kitaka Cave. The cave served as roosting site for about 100,000 individuals of the Egyptian fruit bat, Rosettus aegyptiacus is the species, a prime suspect as reservoir for Marburg. The team members, wearing Tyvek suits, rubber boots, goggles, respirators, gloves, and helmets, were shown to the shaft by miners who, as usual, were clad only in shorts, T-shirts, and sandals. Guano covered the ground. The miners clapped their hands to scatter low-hanging bats as they went. The bats, panicked, came streaming out. These were sizable animals, each with a 2-foot wingspan, not quite so large and hefty as the flying foxes of Asia, but still daunting, especially with thousands swooshing at you in a narrow tunnel. Before he knew it, Ammon had been conked in the face by a bat and suffered a cut over one eyebrow. Towner got hit too. Fruit bats have long, sharp thumbnails. And later, because of the cut, Ammon would get a post-exposure shot against rabies. He didn't get a post-exposure shot against Marburg because there is no shot. Although, as he said, Marburg was a more immediate concern. Yeah, he thought, he told me, this could be a really good place for transmission. The cave had several shafts, Ammon explained. The main shaft was about 8 feet high. Because of all the mining activity along there, many of the bats had shifted their roosting preference and went over to, he said, went over to what we called the Cobra Shaft. That was a smaller shaft branching off, which I interrupted him. Cobra? Because there were cobras? Yeah, there was a Black Forest cobra in there, he said. Or maybe a couple. It was good, dark habitat for snakes with plenty of water and plenty of bats to eat. Anyway, the miners showed Ammon and Towner into the cave past another narrow shaft that led to a place called the Hole, a pit about 10 feet deep, accessed by shinnying down a pole from the bottom of which came much of the ore. The two Americans were looking for the hole, but following their guides, they inadvertently passed that shaft by, continuing about 200 meters along the main shaft to a chamber containing a body of brown, tepid water. Then the local fellows cleared out, leaving Towner and Ammon to do a bit of exploring on their own. They dropped down beside this brown lake and found that chamber branched into three shafts, each of which seemed to be blocked by standing water. Peering into those shafts, they could see many more bats. The humidity was high and the temperature maybe 10 or 15 degrees hotter than outside. Their goggles fogged up. The respirators became soggy and wouldn't pass much oxygen. They were panting and sweating, zipped into their Tyvek suits, which felt like wearing a trash bag. And by now they were becoming a little loopy, Ammon recalled. One lakeside shaft seemed to curve back around, possibly connecting with the Cobra shaft. They didn't know how deep the water might be, and the airspace above it was limited. Should they proceed? No, they decided. The increased risk wasn't worth the potential benefit. Good sense for that. Pierre Fourmonti, their WHO colleague, eventually found them down there and said, hey guys, the hole is back this way. So they crawled out and retraced their path. But by that time, we were spent, Ammon told me. We had to get out and cool off. It was only their first underground excursion at Kataka. They would make several. On a later day, the team investigated a grim remote chamber they dubbed the Cage. It was where one of the four infected miners had been working just before he got sick. This time, Ammon, Fourmonti, and Alan Kemp of the NICD went to the far recesses of the cave. The cage itself could only be entered by crawling through a low gap at the base of a wall, like sliding under a garage door that hadn't quite closed. Brian Ammon is a large man, 6'3" and 220 pounds, and for him, the gap was a tight squeeze. His helmet got stuck, and he had to pull it through separately. You come out into this sort of blind room, he said, and the first thing you see is just hundreds of these dead bats. They were Egyptian fruit bats, the creature of interest, left in various stages of mummification and rot. Piles of dead and liquescent bats seemed a bad sign, potentially invalidating the hypothesis that the Egyptian fruit bats might be a reservoir host of Marburg. If these bats had died in masses from the virus, then they couldn't also be its reservoir. Then again, they might have succumbed to earlier efforts by the locals to exterminate them with fire and smoke. Locals wanted to get the bats out of there, so maybe they had killed them. Their cause of death was indeterminable without more evidence, and that's partly why the team was there. If these bats had died of Marburg, suspicion would shift elsewhere to another bat, or maybe a rodent, or a tick, or a spider as the reservoir. Those other suspects might have to be investigated. Ticks, for instance. There were plenty of them in crevices near the bat roosts, waiting for the chance to drink some blood. Meanwhile, when Ammon and Kemp stood up in the cage, having come under this garage door, they realized that not every bat in there was dead. The room was a swirl with live ones circling around their heads. The two men went to work collecting. They stuffed dead bats into bags. They caught a few live bats. All this is by hand, with gloves. They caught a few live bats and bagged them too. Then, back down on their bellies, they scooched out through the low gap. It was really unnerving, Ammon told me. I'd probably never do it again. One little accident, he said. A big rock rolls in the way, and that's it. You're trapped. Wait a minute. This is me now. Wait a minute. Let me get this straight. You're in a cave in Uganda, surrounded by Marburg and rabies and Black Forest cobras, wading through a slurry of dead bats, getting hit in the face by live ones like Tippi Hedren and the birds, and the walls are alive with thirsty ticks, and you can hardly breathe, and you can hardly see, and you've got time to be claustrophobic. Uganda is not famous for its mine rescue teams, he said. And that section goes on into the science after the field work. But I'm not going to go on. I'm going to stop there, having given you, I hope, a little bit of the flavor as well as some of the ideas of this, and invite some questions. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that interesting talk. It reads like fiction, you know.
It's all good, fact, though.
Good writing, no. could you please speak about are there any cures? Have they found any? You know, that aspect. And also, I forgot, AIDS, was that brought over? Was that carried from monkeys in Africa to other parts of the world? Those two things.
Okay. Cures, they're working on vaccines against some of these. There are some antiviral treatments. Antibiotics don't work against viruses. Viruses are difficult to treat. So mostly the way something like Ebola or Marburg is treated when it's in a person is just with supportive care. There's a term for that, and I can't think of it right now. But there is no cure. And SARS, again, a virus, there is no cure. What they do is essentially make the person comfortable, make sure they have enough fluids, give them supportive care to make it possible, perhaps, for their body to defeat the virus. And in some cases, they have serums that contain antibodies from other patients. In some cases, they've treated Ebola and Marburg with blood serum from other Ebola or Marburg patients who have survived and who have developed some antibodies to it. And in some cases, they create antibodies or try to create antibodies, for instance, in a horse as a model animal, and use those as antiviral treatment.
Antibody would be where the person was infected and the blood developed.
Yeah, an antibody is a kind of molecule that your immune system creates to battle against infections. And they are very specific. So if you have antibodies, I mean, that's how vaccines work. Vaccines provoke our bodies to create antibodies specific to the particular virus or whatever we're being vaccinated against. In terms of AIDS, I can't remember how much of this I mentioned, but it's now known from some molecular phylogenetics, some wonderful research that's been done just in the last 5 years, that the pandemic strain of the AIDS virus, the pandemic strain of HIV, spilled over from one chimpanzee in the southwest into one human in the southeastern corner of Cameroon in Central Africa around the year 1908 or earlier, give or take a margin of error. And that's very different from what we've been told, very different from what we think we know about the origins of the AIDS pandemic. You know, if you first heard about it in the early 1980s, it had been in humans for decades and decades before that. We know it was in people in the city that became Kinshasa as early as 1959 and 1960 because tissue samples from a pathology lab have been retrospectively screened, and they have found them. They have found two samples HIV positive from 1959 and 1960. They have found a degree of divergence between those two samples that suggests the most recent common ancestor of those two samples in a human dated back 50 years. That plus a lot of other complicated science is how they put the date back to 1908. They place it to southeastern Cameroon because the pandemic strain of the virus, which is HIV 1 group M, very, very closely matches the virus, the precursor virus that's found in chimpanzees from that particular area. All of the HIV 1 group M viruses in humans around the world are a twig on a branch of the diversity that's shown among chimpanzees in southeastern Cameroon.
Killed people since 1908, but we weren't
aware. Probably, but we don't really know. The hypothesis is that there is a scenario that's called the cut hunter hypothesis. It can't be known for sure, but it's a very plausible hypothesis, and that is that a human killed and butchered a chimpanzee back then. The chimpanzee had the virus, and the human, presumably a man, cut himself and got blood-to-blood contact, chimpanzee blood and his blood, and the virus spilled over into him that way.
Question back here.
I actually have two questions. One is a really specific one because you talked so much about bats, and you know bats have this white nose disease, and
fungus.
I don't know.
It's a fungus.
It's a fungus? Oh, it's not a virus. So there's no concern about that.
No, that's a very different thing.
I thought that was maybe a virus.
That's in hibernating bats of North America, and it is a fungus that thrives in the conditions of the caves and places like that where bats hibernate through the winter in North America. And it's killed millions of North American bats, not big fruit bats, but micro bats, insectivorous bats. It is not a threat to humans, as far as we know. But it's killed a lot of bats.
Okay.
The fungus is, I can't remember the scientific name, but the syndrome, the disease is called white nose syndrome.
Thanks.
Because it makes a white filament around their noses and on their wings.
So the second question really is, after all of this work and getting to know some of these people who work for the CDC and the WHO and all that sort of thing, how much confidence did that end up giving you in what is now a sort of global team that can really mobilize quickly and get on these cases, which is what seems to have happened recently? I mean, they're really right there. Containing things that in some ways feels like how can you contain that when you've got people flying to Toronto and, infecting other people, that sort of thing. I'm just wondering how you ended up feeling about that
The more I researched this, the more I learned about it, the more my irrational fears were replaced by rational fears.
Explain more.
But the rational fears are smaller in scope than my irrational fears had been. I am very impressed by the people who are out there working on these things, by their intelligence, by their dedication, by their guts, and by the tools that they have, the tools of molecular biological diagnostics, identification, characterization of viruses, precisely, speedily. There's one fellow here in the Bay Area, and there's one fellow in New York City who have independently developed chips that you can use to, you put a drop of blood serum on a chip and you can recognize up to 1,000 different viruses as long as you have the genomes or parts of the genomes of those viruses. So fast diagnostics. If Nathan Wolf were here, he could talk to us about vigilance out in the field. That's his specialty, one of his specialties, and that would be very interesting. I wish he were here. He's a very interesting guy. He's not a character in my book because I never managed to get into the field with him, but if I had been able to, he would be. There's a very impressive network of fast identification, recognition, diagnosis, and response around the world. What you can't do is predict exactly what it's going to be, what the next big one will be, where it's going to come from. You can just have an informed sense of where we should watch and how we should watch. And one thing I'd add in terms of responding and containing these things, when SARS broke out, the scientists and the public health people did manage to identify it and get around it and contain it very quickly, or it would have been, as I said, much, much worse, could have been much worse. That was partly because of good science, fast science, good public health, strong public health measures. It was also because of a certain amount of luck. It spilled over in southern China. It came out through Hong Kong to Toronto, Beijing, Singapore, and Hanoi. Think about those cities. Those are orderly, firmly governed command and control cities. Singapore, Beijing, Toronto, good healthcare systems and strong governments capable of saying, okay, people, now you're all going to do this and you're not going to do that. If that particular virus had spilled over in the central Congo and had come to an airport like the airport in Kinshasa and spread through the city of Kinshasa and then moved from Kinshasa to Libreville, Gabon, and Nairobi, and some slightly less command and control strong cities, to put it politely, then it might have been much different.
Sweetie, actually, I have a kind of an issue. I'm David's wife, so I can call him sweetie. It actually makes me nervous when you say that that SARS was dealt with so diligently, because actually in the process of dealing with SARS, hundreds of thousands of civets, the civet cats were killed, and they were an innocent bystander, or they didn't need to be killed in order to stop the SARS virus. They were identified as the species that were reservoir species, but they were not in fact reservoir species. And one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot is what happens when there is a so-called reservoir species that may or may not be the reservoir species, even if it is the reservoir species, the extermination of that species in order to control the disease actually is a very, very it's a problem. You know what I'm talking about. I'd like to hear you speak about that, because if you target a species as a reservoir species that may be a reservoir species or may not be a reservoir species, you're killing an entire population of an animal, and there are problems with that as well.
It's true that the masked palm civet was suspected to be the reservoir host in the early stages of SARS. And as there was a cull of the pigs in Malaysia, there was a big cull of these masked palm civets in southern China, because they thought that this was the reservoir host. We need to get these out of the markets. I don't know if it was hundreds of thousands. Have I used that number? But anyway, quite a few.
When I was in Mongolia, that was the number
And that's an issue with bats, too. Although with bats, generally it is true that the bats are the reservoir host. But there is a tendency, I ran into this in Australia, for people to say, well, the bats are the reservoirs of particularly racing people who saw their horses dying and saw their veterinarians dying. Tendency to say, well, our horses are important, our veterinarians are important. This virus is carried by the bats. Let's exterminate the bloody bats. Wrong response. Because it's unfair to the animals, and because it's also ineffective, it's disruptive, it's costly in terms of all the other services in an ecosystem that bats in particular perform.
How do you make that point?
What do you mean by? Well, I'm trying to make the point in the book, and I'm trying to make it here.
Well, I'm always fascinated. I have a background in science, and I know how long and arduous it is to grasp science, think scientifically, the scientific method, all. I'm always fascinated by people such as yourself who do not have a background in science, how you can put your hands on grasp, these often very difficult and obscure or arcane type of facts and put them all together. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, thank you. I read a lot of journal articles. I do a lot of homework. I talk to the scientists. And then I've learned from experience that it's important after I've written a draft of a book like this to send chapters to the scientists who have been my sources. Now, if I had ever graduated from journalism school, they probably would have told me not to do that. Don't show your drafts to your sources. But with scientists, I find that they generally are very capable of distinguishing between making a factual correction and trying to manipulate my spin, trying to influence, trying to leverage me in terms of the way I portray them. So I've had very good luck asking scientists. I did that with this book. Nearly every chapter that work deals with the, or passage that deals with the work of scientists, I sent it to them and asked them for factual corrections, and got, you know, very good responses. And that was true with Towner and Ammon in terms of the Kataka Cave scene. They both read that in draft, and they made a number of sort of contingent corrections. No, that wasn't the person who was with me in the cage. It was the other guy who was there. Yeah.
You've mentioned the hantavirus outbreak in Yosemite, and you've mentioned how bats are a reservoir species. It's a little generous of me to be calling bats small animals, but are there any documented cases of larger animals, like, say, coyotes or bears being reservoirs?
Reservoirs? That's a good question. I can't think of any. Hanta has its reservoir in rodents, mostly deer mice. Ebola, probably bats, Marburg bats, all these other animals. Bats. Oh, Lyme disease in deer. Now that's a misconception. I mean, that I go into in the book. Yes, deer, white-tailed deer, are reservoirs of Lyme disease, but they're not the crucial reservoirs that control the prevalence of Lyme disease and the prospect that humans are going to get Lyme disease in a particular locale, a particular forest. Although there's been a lot of publicity suggesting that, and people have said, well, again, like what Betsy said, you know, there was a lot of sentiment when Lyme was first discovered to be in white-tailed deer. We need to get rid of our white-tailed deer. We need to kill off these white-tailed deer in this part of Connecticut. We got too many white-tailed deer. So, and some islands off of the New England coast, they started granting people rights to, you know, wholesale kill deer, thinking that if they got rid of the deer, they'd get rid of the Lyme disease. And this fellow named Rick Osfeld has worked on that system for 20 years, and what he's found is that there is another species of mouse, a white-footed mouse, that is a very important reservoir of the Lyme disease spirochete. It's a type of bacterium called a spirochete. And immature ticks jump on these little mice, and they suck their blood, and they acquire the infection from the mice. And then they grow, and they molt, and they go through their life phases. And then they jump on white-tailed deer, and they drink some more blood, and they mate. They find their mates on the white-tailed deer, and a single deer might have 1,000 ticks on it. And the females latch on to suck blood, and the males, it's a great big singles bar. The males go around and mate with the females. But by that time, the ticks are already infected. And the ticks pass the infection to the white-tailed deer if the white-tailed deer aren't already infected. So the point of all this is that if you have just a few white-tailed deer and you have plenty of white-footed mice, you will have a high prevalence of Lyme disease in that ecosystem. It doesn't matter if you have a lot of deer or a few deer, as long as you have a presence of deer to complete that cycle, and you have lots of white-footed mice, then you'll have lots of Lyme disease. And the one way you're likely to get lots of white-footed mice is if you have a low diversity of small mammals in that ecosystem. You have few chipmunks, you have few squirrels, you have few foxes, maybe you don't have any owls, some of the predatory birds too. And if you have a very small patch of forest with very little biological diversity in it, but it does have white-footed mice, then there will be plenty of those white-footed mice, and there will be plenty of Lyme disease, even if there's only one deer in the whole forest. And then when your kids go out to play, they will get bit by ticks that have become infected, and they'll get Lyme disease.
Yes. I'm interested in your perspective on the public policy implications of the information you're sharing today. I have some friends at CDC, and we were talking about the movie Contagion that mm-hmm. was out a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. And the cycling effect of infections and the efforts of society to not only manage the infection, but manage the interpersonal community reaction to those things. What's your sense of how prepared are we?
Well, I think we're not very well prepared because people don't understand how these diseases work and why they function the way that they do. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book, not to tell people, okay, here are five bullet points on what you can do at the end of the book, but as I say near the end of the book, you know, don't start trying to apply your knowledge until you have some. I think if people understand the connectedness of these phenomena better and the causality, then they'll be able to react a little bit more intelligently. But in terms of what we can expect as a public and how people are going to react to it, I think it's hard to say. I think there will be some stringent public health measures that will probably come in when we start to get more of these really scary transmissible outbreaks. I think you'll have, you know, 13 years ago you could get on a plane with a pocket knife. You can't get on a plane with a pocket knife now. You can still get on a plane with a virus. It may become hard to get on a plane with a virus because we'll be passing through infrared scanners that are telling the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Health and Human Services who has a fever. And if you've got a 102-degree fever, you may not be allowed to get on an airplane. Just a guess.
Thanks to David Kalman for his remarks this evening. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you very much.